the legendary drivers and bodyguards of the governor and his family, as well as other high-placed government officials. I bet they are really pleased to be here. Despite being a traditional beauty, blonde with blue eyes, Carol Fisk was not your usual decorative politician's wife. She was directly involved in setting policy. A graduate of Bowling Green with a postgraduate degree from Cambridge and a law degree to boot, she was a United States District Judge, the first woman in the Equality State to hold the post. As First Lady, Carol worked on behalf of a number of causes, including equal pay for women, sorely needed in a state where men with a high school education earn more than women with college degrees. A big proponent of public education and libraries, she was also a champion of literacy, and I found it very difficult not to admire her, present circumstances notwithstanding. Her husband, Wally the Gov, was a likable, tough individual with an aviation background who'd made his fortune building cranes and whose greatest skill was getting the fractious facets of state government to work together, sometimes even getting them to think it was their idea.
"Hi, how is everybody?"
Miss Fisk looked around the room.
"It's wonderful to see all of you, and I appreciate your coming here to talk about one of my many, many causes."
There was a collective smattering of laughter.
"As most of you know, one of the concerns making me think about the way we implement the compassionate release of inmates in the state is that spending has ballooned and overcrowding in the prison system has become a burden."
One of the TV talking heads interrupted. "So this is being done primarily for economic reasons?"
She smiled at him. "I'll be taking questions later in the press conference, so if you could please hold your questions until then, I'd appreciate it."
She resettled herself and glanced our way, and I was pretty sure we'd just been found out.
"It's difficult to implement overarching legislation concerning compassionate release in that the individual cases vary to a great degree, and because the implementation relies on the criteria of a medical petition where a great deal of inconsistency hinders the process."
One of the Bobs, Robert, spotted us in the back and made a face, and a few of the press folks laughed.
"Things have gotten a bit better for prisoners suffering from terminal illnesses, thanks to the new prison hospice program, but that cannot replace the comfort of dying with dignity among family and friends."
She glanced at the reporter who had interrupted, figuring the smattering of laughter must have had to do with him.
"Not to mention the cost to the state." The First Lady glanced around, a little bit confused, but plowing ahead nonetheless. "And then, obviously, there are the cases where there is no proper medical care available in a prison setting."
Now Bob was looking at Robert, and of course the man couldn't resist fooling around, but this time the governor's wife happened to be looking in his direction.
"Is there something wrong with you, Robert?"
He straightened up and cleared his throat, looking like a teenager who'd been caught passing notes.
"No, ma'am. Sorry."
She looked at the other Bob to see if he was up to something, and then faced forward again, looking directly at me.
"As I was saying, with lots of aging inmates in the system, and the poor health of that population in comparison with the general public, compassionate release can go a long way toward alleviating costs. Nevertheless, each case still has to be judged on an individual basis, which brings me to the one at hand."
I ducked my head and pretended to brush an imaginary piece of lint from my shirt front, then listened quietly to the rest of the press conference, while studiously avoiding eye contact with either of the Bobs. After the First Lady finished her prepared remarks, there was a flurry of questions, which she answered gracefully before exiting through the double doors that led to the mansion proper. After a moment, the Bobs were standing in front of me.
"You got us in trouble."
"You got yourselves in trouble, and you got me in trouble, too." Robert shook hands with Vic and Henry and then glanced around.
"Sounds like your man is going to walk."
"Maybe."
Bob leaned in. "We can always go into the hospital and take him for the proverbial ride, but I don't think he'd make it to the curb."
At that moment, another man approached, smaller and not wearing a uniform or a gun.
"Sheriff Longmire?"
"Yep."
"I'm Mark Rivera, the press secretary to First Lady Fisk. She'd like to speak with you in the library."
Vic smirked.
"You're in trouble."
I nodded to the functionary.
"Okay."
He gestured toward the door.
"Now, please." I glance at Vic, Henry, and then the Bobs.
You bet.
The sun was just creeping over the high plains, at the rimmed cliffs, as I finished my report to Joe Holland in the borrowed railroad office in the tower overlooking the Rock Springs rail yard.
I appreciate this, Deputy, especially after the rough treatment I've given you recently.
I delicately touched my head and put my hat back on at an angle so that it didn't press directly on the wound.
It's all right, I've been hit harder. Earlier tonight, as a matter of fact.
I sipped the wretched coffee from the cracked Union Pacific mug he'd provided, and then rested it back on the metal desk between us.
What are you planning on doing?
We've got an APB out on the quay, but nothing so far.
I agree with you that the last place I'd be would be on this train if I'd killed somebody.
He must have jumped ship back in Medicine Bow, if he's the one that hit you, but I can't imagine how or exactly when. I mean, we were all standing outside the train, and I can't help but think that somebody would have seen him get back on. And never mind that from there, where the hell do you go?
So if they found Leland's body at Fort Fred Steele, and if it is McKay who killed Marv, why hit me? Wouldn't you do the deed and bolt?
He shook his head.
Damned if I know.
I shrugged. Anybody else missing?
Nope.
Everybody else on the manifest is still aboard and will stay that way till we get back to Cheyenne.
House arrest?
Train arrest.
He frowned at all the paperwork splayed in front of him.
I've got to tell you that I'm not real thrilled with all this.
Well, I can understand.
He waved a hand, dismissing my statement.
Aside from what appears to be a probable murder, I've got a whole train full of sheriffs, law enforcement professionals who, instead of helping, are second-guessing every move I make.
I stood and walked over to the window that faced the tracks, wiped some of the dust away, and gazed into the flat yellow morning light. An arched neon red sign announced, "Home of Rock Springs Coal. Welcome."
Oh, I wouldn't take those sheriffs personally. I think they'd do the same thing to each other.
Some of them still think you did it.
Well, they're welcome to prove it in a court of law.
There was a silence.
You mind if I ask you a question?
As long as I don't have to incriminate myself.
You're the man on this train with the least seniority, but you're very good at investigating.
He stood and placed his hands in his pockets.
What exactly did you do in the service?
I looked at him, and then, just as I turned back toward the window, I could have sworn I saw out of the corner of my eye a 59 Thunderbird convertible make a turn and disappear. Maybe I just wanted to see one.
Marine Corps investigator.
Ah, he smiled. Any ideas as to why McKay would have done it?
I hedged. None whatsoever. I mean, he's a hothead, but I think that's only because he thought something was going on between me and the blonde he's traveling with.
Have you spoken to her?
He looked at a list lying on the surface of the borrowed disk.
Next.
Anybody else on that list?
Your boss.
I don't think he did it.
You second-guessing me, too?
I turned back to the railroad bull.
No, but I can pretty much vouch for his whereabouts, till Medicine Bow and after Wamsutter.
He stared back at me.
Curiously enough, all the excitement happened in the period when you weren't on the train.
You checked my story?
Sure did. We can't find the people on the bus you described, but everybody at the Shiloh Saloon says you were there and not in the best of shape.
He walked over and looked out the gritty glass with me.
That still doesn't get your boss off the hook, though.
Give me a motive and I'll think about it.
I'd been thinking long and hard about whether to share the information that the dead man had relayed to me, but I didn't see any other way of advancing the investigation.
Sheriff Leland thought he was onto something. Over the past few years, there have been a number of unaccounted-for murders in the state of individuals who have evaded justice. Leland had a suspicion that it was someone in the Sheriff's Association, maybe even a group, what he called a cabal, who have taken the law in their own hands. He suspected they were exchanging murders in each other's counties so that they wouldn't get caught doing it.
Holland stood there staring at me.
Well, that certainly opens up the motivational aspect of the investigation.
If there's anything to it, you're going to need to find out which sheriffs have been in office for the last 3 years, where they've been in the state, and whether that coincides with the people who have been killed. I pulled the piece of paper from my shirt pocket and handed it to him. Mr. Leland gave me this list of sheriffs he was suspicious of. You'll notice that Lucian isn't on the list. He took the paper and studied it. My God, it's half the sheriffs in Wyoming.
I know.
I think he was hoping to narrow the possibilities on this trip, but it looks as if someone got wind of Leland's investigation and took things into his own hands.
Sheriff Leland shared this with you?
Me and Lucian. And I don't know how many others. Neither you nor Lucian is on here. He looked down the list of names. McKay isn't on here either. I thought about the fact that my boss's sidearm had been fired, but until I had more to go on, I felt no need to share that information.
No.
He leaned an elbow on the window frame.
You know, it's possible McKay's dead too, lying out there on the track somewhere between here and Medicine Bow.
Yep.
And we've still got a killer or two or three on the Western Star.
He moved over to the desk and picked up a telephone.
I guess we'd better have somebody check the rails from here to Medicine Bow.
Yep.
What are your plans?
I yawned and glanced down the tracks through the snow flurries. The Western Star appeared to be catching her breath. I think I'll head back to the dining car and have breakfast. I'm hungry. He nodded and then spoke into the phone.
Just a second.
He turned back to me as I reached the door.
I'll meet you on the train?
Sure.
And if you don't mind sending Miss Leclerc in?
I pushed open the door and found her sitting on a leather chair.
Howdy.
She looked at me and burst into a fresh set of tears.
I can't believe this is happening to me.
I sat in the chair next to her.
It'll be okay, he just needs to talk to you. Tell the truth and you'll be fine.
She wiped her eyes and looked at me.
Yeah, that always works, huh?
Well, actually, most of the time it does. I tipped my hat back and looked at her.
You mind if I ask you a question?
Okay.
When was the last time you saw McKay?
She sniffled. George?
Yep, George.
He was really mad when we got back to the cabin and said a bunch of stuff about you.
And when was that?
I don't know. When we got back to the cabin one time.
She sniffed.
Do you really think he did all this?
I honestly don't know, but he's gone missing, and that makes him a suspect.
Somebody was killed, they say.
Marv Leland, the sheriff of Uinta County.
The nice old fella with the one arm?
Yep, him.
Oh, that's a shame.
That's pretty much how everybody feels about it. I took her hands in mine in an attempt to get her to focus. What time did George leave your cabin?
I don't know.
Had the train stopped? She thought about it.
Yes, it was stopped.
And he never came back after that?
No.
I thought about the brief conversation we'd had trackside. Did George ever talk about the other sheriffs? Specifically Marv Leland?
Well, he talked a lot about the Sheriff's Association. I think he was trying to impress me, you know, to get me in the sack. Wasn't the one-armed fella the head of the sheriffs?
Yep. What did George say, can you remember?
Just that he thought he should be the next in line, but that there were a couple of older men who were more likely to get it. Even after he said he'd done a bunch of trips with the association. Fundraising for their elections, I think.
How many trips were there?
Oh, a half dozen, I think he said.
Over how long of a period of time?
I don't know, at least a year or two. Way before me. Before that he said he was focusing on his own election.
She smiled.
You've got to remember, I've only known him for a few days.
Just one more question. Are George's things still in your cabin?
Yes. Why?
Did he take anything with him when he left? A bag or something?
No.
She thought about it.
Well, there was a small case he had.
Any idea what was in it?
No.
Would you mind if I take a look around your berth? I thought if I could go through his things, it might give us an idea of where he went. I smiled at her. Do you have a key? She rifled through her pocketbook and finally produced it, attached to a large brass chain.
Here you go.
No, you hold on to it. I'm going to go have some breakfast, and then, when you're through here, I'll meet you at your cabin, deal?
She sniffed once more. Deal.
Now you'd better get in there and tell Mr. Holland everything you know.
That won't take long.
She stood, and I did the same. She placed a hand on my chest.
Thank you.
No problem. I was just pulling away when, with an amazing amount of strength, she brought my face down to hers, but I wasn't taken by surprise this time and resisted. She smiled disappointedly.
Can't blame a girl for trying.
She turned away and approached the office door, where Holland stood, holding the knob and studying the floor.
Miss Leclerc?
She straightened her fur and turned, giving me a playful wave. I pulled my hat down, bandages be damned, flipped up the collar of my jacket, and stuffed my hands in my pockets as I bumped open the door and took the metal stairway back down to the huffing Western Star. As I walked up the tracks toward the dining car, I saw Sheriff Connolly knocking the used tobacco from his pipe by tapping it on the heel of his boot.
How did it go?
He let me walk. Lucian handed me my paperback.
Gibbs said he found this in the caboose. Thought you might want it.
I took the book and stuffed it in the pocket of my jacket.
Thanks.
He looked up at the ironclad sky.
Weather's changing,
he pronounced, as if it were a philosophical statement.
I'd say that if we don't get moving, we're going to get snowed on.
He glanced around dismissively at the flurries, but his eyes sharpened.
I mean really snowed on.
Yep.
You tell him about my gun?
No. I studied him.
Should I have?
He lit the pipe with a match and puffed to get it going.
I'd say that's up to you.
I smiled down at him.
That's why I didn't.
I thought back to the interview, and then the post-interview with Kim Leclerc. But I just spoke to her. She had something interesting to say.
The Chanteuse?
I shook my head at the nomenclature. Yep, she intimated to me that George McKay had made a number of trips to different counties over the last couple of years for the Sheriff's Association. Lucian's eyes darkened.
What kinds of trips?
Well, he said fundraising, but I don't think either of us would be inclined to believe that. He smoked his pipe, unconsciously imitating the steam emanating from the locomotive behind us.
Bringing George McKay in for fundraising would be like bringing me in for public relations.
He then stamped his foot and turned, lifting his good leg up onto the stairs, trailing the prosthetic behind him.
Come on, I'll buy you breakfast.
Does that mean I'm back on the payroll? He thought about it.
Well, call it probation.
The First Lady was sitting on a rolling ladder when I entered the mansion library, cradling an ancient-looking leather tome in her manicured hands. This is the first edition of the English version of Les Miserables, Carlton Publishing, 1862. Do you believe that? I looked around at the tiger-striped oak furniture, the wood paneling, Tiffany fixtures, and the oriental carpets. Maybe we should sell it and raise some money for the care of inmates. She ignored my comment. I keep telling Wally that we should take all these books and put them at our place just to protect them. She glanced around. But he says this mansion belongs to the people of Wyoming and that the collection needs to remain here. Her eyes came back to me. How many of the people of Wyoming do you think have actually read this book?
Does starting it count?
She smiled. I know you have, Walter. That's one of the things I really like about you, both a man of action and a man of thought. I walked closer and laid an arm on the brass rail. Say, you are in politics, aren't you? And you're not? I made a face. I think I've run my last race. Gonna let that Basque deputy of yours or that spitfire of an undersheriff handle the county?
Maybe.
She studied me for a moment and then looked back at the book in her hands. I've always loved this novel. It has so much to say about human society. Character.
Justice.
She smiled again, but it quickly faded. I'm surprised by you, Walt. I never thought of you as a vengeful person.
Pharisaic, I think, is the word you're looking for.
Maybe.
She looked down.
You know, I'm not used to begging for prisoners' lives.
Is that what you're doing, begging?
I don't want to have a grudge match in the papers with you, Walt.
I haven't said a word to anybody.
You don't have to. The fact that you're here in Cheyenne speaks volumes.
Feeling the grain, she rubbed the palm of her hand over the cover of the book.
Mistranslated from the French, most people think it means the miserable or wretched ones, but I think a better translation would be the dispossessed or the outsiders.
Pretty much describes everyone in the book.
Yes, it does. Especially the police investigator, Javert.
I didn't say anything.
Pharisaic, isn't that the word you used? Imagine a man so bound by the rule of law that he would rather die than bend even the smallest one.
All the characters and their motivations are products of their society. That's why it's such a marvelous book. But there's a difference between the story in your hands and ours.
And what's that?
The prisoner in our story is not guilty of stealing a loaf of bread, but of taking lives, numerous lives. Now, you may think I'm intractable, but I see myself as an instrument of the law, and in my county, or in my book, for that matter, there is no slide rule of justice. Guilty is guilty. She replaced one of the greatest novels ever written on the top shelf and lowered the heavy glass that protected the books.
And the difference between you and Javert?
I held out a hand, which she took. I can reconcile my devotion to the law and the knowledge that a lawful course can sometimes be immoral. She walked past me toward a large partner's desk.
And you don't see anything immoral in forcing an aged, weak, terminally ill man to die in prison?
It's the law. He was tried, found guilty, and duly sentenced.
Why does this come as such a surprise?
He was given multiple life sentences. Why is it suddenly so difficult to understand that he was condemned to die incarcerated?
Walt, I can't help but think that this is something personal.
She turned to look at me.
I'm going to advise Wally to commute the sentence.
I took a deep breath and slowly exhaled. You do as you see fit, Carl. But you weren't there. This is the best damn biscuits and gravy I've ever had. Gibbs grinned, refilling Lucian's coffee cup.
I got that recipe from the chef at Gatsby's Tavern on the George Washington C&O line. They retired the 965 about 5 years ago, but it was a heck of a galley. Monsieur Henri Lafontaine was a chef, a Creole from down Louisiana way, and he wouldn't use anything but that good Andouille sausage. That's what makes a difference.
I paused between bites. Mr. Gibbs, how long have you been working for the railroad?
All of them? Since 1932, but it ain't the same as it used to be. Once upon a time, we had class, rolling class, but since they've been making all the cuts and everything, I don't know how much longer there will even be a railroad. Pretty soon we'll just be a bus on rails.
Lucian sipped his coffee. There'll always be railroads as long as Wyoming's got coal, and we got plenty of that.
Maybe so, but I don't know about these passenger trains, Sheriff.
He refilled my cup.
But it ain't just the trains, it's the people.
I nodded. Taking the current events as an example? I wouldn't judge everybody like these sheriffs, Mr. Gibbs. Most of the regular citizenry are better behaved.
I don't know, Mr. Longmire. Every time we run a train, things have been disappearing. These cups you're drinking out of? Hats, blankets? Somebody even ran off with the meat cleaver out of the kitchen.
Lucian looked at his watch. The world ain't what it used to be, that's for sure.
He stood.
I'm supposed to go talk to that goofball Holland.
He glanced at me.
Where the hell is he, anyway?
I nodded toward the back. He's in the office up in the tower, second floor. Lucian looked at his leg.
Well, hell.
I got in one more sip of coffee before folding my napkin and placing it over my empty plate. Which reminds me, I've got an appointment with Miss Leclerc to see if I can find anything in their cabin that might help us figure out where McKay is.
Sheriff Connolly pulled his jacket from the back of his chair, as a few of the other sheriffs stumbled in for an early breakfast, and Gibson over to pour them coffee.
Holland know about that?
I don't care if he does or not. The Leclerc woman says she'll unlock the berth and I'll have her stand there